Welcome to the Pharmacy Business and Career Network podcast, brought to you by the Pharmacy Guild of Australia, focusing on pharmacy management and ownership. The PBCN podcast supports the improvement and growth of your business performance with insights and advice from a range of industry professionals. The PBCN podcast, supporting your journey every step of the way.
As we wrap up 2018 and head into the new year, we thought we'd take stock of the first 10 episodes of the PBCN podcast. We've gone back and listened to each episode and picked out a few of our favourite parts, the real gold nuggets from the awesome guests we've had so far. In episode one, Philip Chapman from LeaseOne joined us to shed some light on the rental leasing landscape, helping you to achieve a broader understanding of the importance of the lease contract, what things to consider when negotiating your lease with the landlord, how to get a better deal, and how best to manage this contract to benefit your pharmacy and ensure longevity and security of tenure. Let me ask some more common questions around some of those common issues we know pharmacies have. And the first one is, so I spoke to my landlord and they made an agreement with me. They can't renege on their word, can they?
Well, thanks for the question, Danny. Look, we get all sorts of various questions, but this one's in particular. Look, until a lease is actually signed and registered by both parties, the deal can change. Unfortunately, a handshake isn't what it used to be. These deals need to be followed through. We need to make sure the paperwork's in order. You know, a retail shop lease is a complex contract, and it's a layer cake of data and information that needs and processes that need to be followed under the different legislation in each state. So understanding and being prepared for that paperwork is part of the research you should understand. But until the ink's dry, it's not a deal.
Next question is, if my lease has an option for further term, I don't need to worry about the expiry, do I? They'll just send me a letter.
Oh, look, there is a couple of states where you will get a reminder letter, but it's not always the case that they meet their obligations. Sometimes the landlords or their agents don't understand their obligations under a lease. You should be in front of this. Once again, putting time on your side. If you've got a lease option, that's your right over someone else's land, and you've got to treat it with respect, and it's valuable to the future of your business. So no, be proactive. Don't sit back and wait.
Can the landlord relocate my business anywhere in the shopping centre?
Daniel, I think this is probably from where someone's got a relocation clause in their lease, and you need to go back through your lease and obviously check that out. But no, they can't just pick you up and put you anywhere. It has to be on similar or same premises. So if you're on the corner of a shopping centre near the supermarket, they can't put you down the back facing the car park. So there are issues there that you can raise with your particular small business commissioners, or certainly with the retail shop leases tenancy units in different states and territories, in relation to raising a dispute if someone tries to relocate you unfairly to premises that aren't similar.
Can I be compensated if the landlord does something that affects my sales?
Oh, most definitely. And this is where we need to do our paperwork and keep our research up to speed. For instance, if there's a redevelopment of the shopping centre, then if sales drop because they've closed the car park, relocated entrances, you know, they've put construction dongers in the way, then certainly keep good records, keep good photographs, and yes, under the respective state legislations, you are to be compensated for loss of business.
If the landlord has notified me that they are redeveloping and invoking the demolition clause, should I be compensated?
Now, this is a tough one, Daniel. Demolition clauses can be tricky. The compensation is very limited in these areas, and it's usually limited to the depreciated value of your fit-out. So when you see a demolition clause, you should certainly explore it further. Check the disclosure statement from the landlord, where they specifically have to advise you if they have actually made applications to council for development. And that'll give you an idea of what risk you're running. But certainly, if you see those clauses, you see a development may be pending, put your hand up and red flag it.
I think next one's my favourite. If I've signed a lease, is that the end of the story?
Oh, most definitely. Put in the bottom drawer and wait for 5 years. No, by all means. Look, in a perfect world, we'd love all the members and all our clients to pull their lease out every year and read it again, and certainly make sure they understand that it's a living document. There are dates and performance clauses in there that go throughout the year. So keep looking at your lease, understand it, and if you don't just give it to your lawyer without instructions. Leave it sit there. Make sure they've got instructions to ring you and review it with you every year, or whoever that may be. But certainly, sticking at the bottom drawer and forgetting about it, thinking it's set and forget, you're going to end up like the case study, waiting 4 months out, wondering if you're going to have a livelihood or not.
No offence, but lease and the contracts, it's not the most fun, it's not the most sexy thing about owning a pharmacy, but loads of great, sage, awesome advice there for people to really, for me, the key takeaway in all of that is to own the lease. Yes, it's a contract signed by multiple parties, but you really can't just stick it in the drawer and hope that you're just going to get another lease that doesn't impact your business in 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years time. So fantastic chat. The South City Wagga Wagga team's goal each day is, and I quote, to make a difference in our patients' lives and to do that by trying to become a premier health destination in the region. Luke Vanderwright and Michael O'Reilly, business partners at South City Wagga Wagga, decided that the best way to achieve that goal was to de-banner the pharmacy and expand the business into a professional services pharmacy. They discussed their journey in episode 2. Michael, how do you see the role of a professional services pharmacy fitting into the overall health management of the wider community?
GPs, let's face it, Daniel, are very time poor. And as a pharmacist, I believe that our industry has a role to play to ease some of the pressure on the GPs. You know, we're in a regional centre in Wagga, and pressure on doctors here is probably worse than it is in the cities. So getting into doctors in Wagga is extremely difficult. So that gives pharmacy in regional areas an opportunity to probably tap into some of that demand and be what I would call primary healthcare, so that sometimes you become the first port of call. If someone can't get into a doctor, they often will go to the pharmacy with dermatology things, with paediatric things with kids, with management of medications. I'm not saying we can take their place by any means, but I think pharmacy, particularly in those regional areas, can really help contribute to the health of the community because we're accessible. You know, no one makes an appointment to come and see a pharmacist. At South City, we've got multiple pharmacists on duty, so we prided ourselves in people being able to basically walk in off the street and sit down with a professional. I don't think you can do that with your accountant or your doctor or your engineer or your solicitor. So I like to think that we're literally primary healthcare, and that we have a very important role to play in community health.
Luke, people are busy. They rush into a pharmacy. They want to grab their products or their scripts quick, or they want to just get some quick advice and they want to get out the door and get on with the next thing. How do you slow that down? How do you broach the subject of positioning the extra value that you can provide them without it coming across as maybe like you're just trying to hold them there and sell them more stuff?
No, that's a very good question. Look, we try and encourage good health. And if we don't believe in a certain program or a certain product, we simply won't run it. I think patients can see through when you're trying to sell them something or whether you're trying to be genuine. And we have a little sort of motto that, you know, essentially we want to make a difference and whatever we're selling needs to make a difference. And I think that really comes across when you're explaining the service and how it will help the patient. And we have a lot of other systems as well. A lot of people are busy and, you know, especially given our after hours, a lot of people are finishing work and they want to get home. And we say, look, we have a booking system online. Go online, have a look at the services we have. And they're available through our website and through platforms such as Facebook. And they can go on and see the services that we have and make a booking at a time that suits them. It also spells out the minutes it would take, all that type of stuff. So we just tell them, you know, do you want us to book in for you next week or would you like to go online and have a look? And that way, you know, they can find a time that's convenient for them. But essentially, we try and sell the program as a benefit to their health. And that's truly what we believe it is.
On the online booking systems and going through Facebook, jumping online, seeing where might be convenient for a patient to book time and come back, how's that technology and that approach been received? Has it been taken up well or is it something that sort of sits off to the side and just maybe a few people use it?
Look, it's been quite surprising. It's been uptaken really well. To be honest, when I put it in, I thought, look, somewhere like Wagga, it's a little bit, if this was in Sydney, people would be using it. And I thought, look, it won't work in Wagga, but it's part of our booking system that we can integrate it into an online booking platform. So why not do it? And then we actually are getting a lot of bookings online. We've seen it recently through, you know, people wanting to get a flu shot. That's been our biggest online booker. The second one's medical certificates. So we get a lot of people going online, seeing if they can get a medical certificate via our website. And then there's a little book now button and it just flows through. Then we receive an email saying Joe Bloggs has come in and, you know, would like a medical certificate. And then you just hit approve or not approve, which obviously in 99% of the cases, we're approving them all. So it's been quite well received. And to be honest, I was a little bit surprised at its uptake, but it's something that's building each and every year.
Luke, I've heard you describe your staff as your biggest asset, and we spoke a little bit about it earlier. So obviously they've been integral to the pharmacy's success. What is your approach to staff management and ensuring that they are engaged with the job and the pharmacy?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. As you said, the sort of the staff at the pharmacy are by far our biggest asset. And look, like I pointed out before, we try not to micromanage them. I think if we all sort of, you know, have to go to work, and you want to make sure the workplace is an enjoyable environment as it can be. That way, sort of, if everyone's having a good time and, you know, we work hard, that energy flows onto the customers when they're sort of in the store and they can see that. So we work constantly, we're working as a team, but they obviously, people need to have the right training as well. Like, we have to be on top of our game as far as sort of our training goes, just so we're able to deliver the newest and latest advice to the patient. So we're constantly, you know, investing in the staff's training. And even we're looking to developing those sort of people all throughout the pharmacy at every level, whether it's sort of someone in the front of store or dispense techs or someone in the dispensary. They need to be kept engaged, A, so we can maintain the staff, and B, that they can sort of be interested in what they're doing. And what we've found is when, you know, we have highly skilled staff and we have enough numbers of staff, that people can take that time to sit down with the patient and discuss their health problems, that, you know, they can really deliver on the health outcomes and the goals that the patient wants. So we try and invest that time into the staff so that can be passed on and delivered to the patients.
Michael, you and your business partner, Luke, are on the Clinical Council of the Murrumbidgee Primary Health Network. Why is it important that you're part of that network, both from a community and also a business perspective?
I think the name of that organisation probably is a giveaway. It's called the Primary Health Network. If pharmacy considers itself primary health, which I certainly do, and Luke and I certainly do, then it's really important that you do form that network. So the Clinical Council is an advisory council to the local primary health network, and they meet quarterly. It's got members who are doctors, dietitians, we got a psychologist on the council, a couple of physios. So we all work together to try and make sure that the programs that the primary health network are implementing are clinically valid. The primary health network does a health assessment, what they call a health needs assessment. So they shop around Wagga, I guess, or the Riverina, and target specific areas that they feel are very important going forward in terms of treating. So the Clinical Council looks at those target areas, and we try and devise plans to combat some of those. We're never going to fix them. You know, they're COPD, diabetes, mental health. We do a lot of work here in Wagga around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, aged care, and preventable admissions into hospital. So, you know, that's like trying to stop the tide coming in to try and block all of those things. But by being on the Clinical Council and knowing what the health network is working on and knowing the areas that they've identified as being deficient, from a business point of view, we're in on the ground floor, because you know what needs the health network is prioritising. It's no coincidence that COPD and diabetes are things that we've identified and run very hard with, just happen to be two of the key areas that the primary health network is concentrating on. They do a lot of work in mental health, and we were able to source some grants out of the primary health network to get staff qualified in a mental health first aid certificate, and we thought outside the box a little bit and thought, well, we can't just ask for our staff to have first mental health first aid. So we approached the Primary Health Network and sold the idea that having pharmacy staff all over our area with mental health first aid training would be useful, and they agreed. So we managed to get, Luke and I are really proud, we got 91 guys accredited through our region in mental health first aid. So it fits their brief, the Primary Health Network, because they're working on mental health as one of their priorities. So if you're involved in the clinical council and you're hearing those sort of things, your input is helping the community as well. You know, you can't be on those things and have it all self-serving, but when you sit there and you think, well, these guys can see problems in the community in preventable admissions, for example, then you can start to tailor some plans as a business to fit in with those key areas. From a community perspective, well, we get back to the network side of it too, because we've been able to meet and work alongside with a wonderful bunch of dedicated dietitians and physios, and establish some wonderful links with the proactive GPs in Wagga. So I think the networking part of clinical council is really, really important.
What would your advice be to other pharmacists and their staff who might be thinking about getting involved in similar health networks in their areas?
I'd say you should put aside your built-in phobia of committees, because I think that they actually are really useful organisations to be involved in as pharmacists. You know, I've mentioned earlier about how I feel the pharmacist-doctor relationship is better than it was. You know, we're not in our own little bubble anymore as pharmacists. You know, we deal, or should deal, we certainly, Luke and I certainly do, deal as closely as possible with the medical people, because we all have this interests of the same person at heart. You know, I would tell anyone, don't forget that we all work for the same person who is the patient. So, you know, some people see committees as onerous things where you sit around and never really resolve anything. Well, I don't agree with that. I think there's certainly, from my experience at Primary Health Network, particularly the clinical council side of it, there is a valuable input that you can make into the health in your region. You know, there is a little bit of benefit in it for us as well as being pharmacists, because you know what the government's looking at. So if you go to Primary Health Network and they're saying that they see a deficiency or an area that needs some work, let's take COPD, for example, and they say at a meeting that we think COPD is underdiagnosed, and you're not sitting in the room and thinking, how can we contribute to solving that, then it gives you wonderful thinking time. So luckily those meetings are only every 3 months, because I reckon Luke and I spend the next 3 months trying to unravel any opportunities that might have arisen out of the previous meeting. So that's where our COPD screening program grew from. It's where our mental health first aid accreditation grew from finding out where the needs were and getting off your backside and doing something about it.
Friendly's Pharmacy in Busselton, WA provide every service that is available in the pharmacy industry. So you can imagine the complexity of the management systems that need to not only support the delivery and management of those services, but do it the right way and efficiently. In episode 3, David Williams took us behind the scenes and discussed not just their success, but also some of the challenges they have faced. Your vision is basically to be the best pharmacy you can be. Tell us what the broad areas that you focus on are that help you try and achieve that vision.
Like, we offer all the CPA services, and then we moved into health checks and, you know, associated services with that. So, the blood pressure checks, blood glucose checks, blood cholesterol. And we also do sleep apnea and weight loss. But the vision is really about not just doing the services, but doing them well and making them successful.
Now, you've recently gone through some changes. You've refocused to being a health services pharmacy. What happened in the business, or what made you realise something that prompted you moving the pharmacy to a health services focused pharmacy? What was the catalyst?
Well, we'd had a lot of pressure from the supermarkets, and we had an IGA in our shopping centre. So it was one of the largest IGAs in WA, but as you know, with these with the independent supermarkets, there's been a pretty steady decline against Coles and Woolworths, and unfortunately, even our IGA was no different, and things were starting to stagnate. And we were doing what you would do in that situation. You're trying to make the most of the opportunities that you have and the customers that you have. But with the decline of the supermarket, we knew that we had to make a change. And actually, that supermarket is completely gone now. So they were offering 75% off Weet-Bix last week, and now they're closed. So it's just us now in there. So, yeah, I'm glad we made the changes when we did. But, we were doing the health services, but we weren't doing them that well. And it was a mature business. So what we've been doing is trying to sort of incrementally make changes to this old business. I guess if it was a car, we'd sort of, putting new wheels on and, giving it a new paint job. But really, I think we just needed a new car. So I guess what we were doing, it wasn't working. And we just had to completely change the model. We had a business partner. There was three of us in this business, and he was an older business partner. He decided to retire, and I think Scott and I both had a pretty strong vision for the future. And I don't know. I guess being a mature business, a lot of people might look at it and say, "Oh, well, why would you? It's going fine." We were beating national and state averages, but I think we could see the writing was on the wall. So I guess with the exit of the partner, we just went for it.
What's been one unexpected challenge that made you sit back and think, oh, wow, okay, I didn't really see that one coming?
Well, some of our customers didn't like it, to be honest. They didn't like the change. It still gets me every time when they say, oh, what have you done? What did you do to the place? And I can't understand it. When we were filming the video for the Pharmacy of the Year Award, I had a customer, regular customer of ours, she agreed to participate in it for us. And I thought, oh, great, it'd be nice to have this customer in the video. And while we were standing aside and they were filming, she started complaining about the layout. She said, oh, why did you change this way? And I said, now you're going to bring this up now.
Is it fair to say that you just thought that everybody would see your vision, that everybody would appreciate what you were trying to achieve, that appreciate the new services and just love it, but that wasn't the case?
Yes. Yeah, that would be a fair summary. I think it just comes down to, first of all, you can't please everybody. There are going to be some people who liked it the way it was, whether it was for, some sort of old charm or, based on the previous experiences they had, and that's what they like. There were most of the people, and we didn't have a lot of people complain, but the ones that did, I think we were able to, they obviously still come to our store, and you're able to show them. They just need to be shown a little bit, what we've been able to do. I think a lot of your customers, don't use all your services. There are a lot of customers that we have that some of these things aren't relevant to them, so it is a bit harder for them to see why we've done what we've done. I think it's just about, you can't please everybody.
No, and one of my favourite sayings is that if you don't have a few people complaining or you're keeping everybody happy, you're probably not trying hard enough.
Yeah, well, that's true. That is definitely true.
In past episodes, we heard from pharmacies that have successfully diversified their offerings. We've heard lots of positive things, and one thing that absolutely sets the foundation, and in fact would be almost impossible to see success without it, is the numbers, the financials. As a partner at MSI Taylor Pharmacy Services, Matthew Harris is an expert in helping pharmacies get the financials right, especially when diversifying, and he joined us in episode 4. You believe that profit can be motivating, obviously, but it's not the most important motivator. Why isn't profit the most important? And if it isn't profit, what should be the most important motivator?
Well, unfortunately, if somebody's not happy in the business that they're working in or not happy doing what they're doing, no matter what you do, you'll never be able to significantly improve the business. They want to be passionate. They want to be enjoy doing it. So I really believe that being happy in what you're doing is the first step, and then trying to structure or manage the business to a point where it gives you the goals you want, then will help you drive it towards a profit.
Part of making a profit is the dispensary. It's a really important part of a pharmacy, and many rely on it heavily for income. Do you think that many pharmacies rely on it too heavily, rely on their dispensary too much? And if so, is it a risk? Why is it a risk and an issue?
Yeah, the dispensary has always been that part of a business that just performs no matter what. Unfortunately, where the regulation and everything else is going, we're losing control of the profitability there. So, yes, it's always going to be there. It's always going to give part of the business. But the only way that you're going to significantly improve the profit is to provide other services and improve the front shop.
So that's all about diversifying your income base. And ballpark, if an average pharmacy, I don't know what an average pharmacy actually looks like. You might be able to give us some advice on that. And a range is okay, but by diversifying a pharmacy's income base, what can a pharmacy sort of reasonably expect to increase their turnover by, and how does that roughly translate into profit?
Well, unfortunately, there's no real average pharmacy per se. There's lots of different types of pharmacies. You've got everything from a 50 square metre dispensary only pharmacy up to a couple of thousand square metre whole of life, everything type of pharmacy. So getting an understanding of what the average pharmacy will gain is a little bit difficult. What I always try and do is I go back and think about what is the pharmacy doing, what professional services, what complementary products are they doing when they're selling everything. And my target's always been to try and get somewhere between 20 and 30% increase in the profitability of a pharmacy from going through and having a review and getting and looking at it.
So a pharmacy owner is looking to diversify, broaden their income base, maybe look for that 20 to 30% increase. Where are the obvious areas that you focus on first? Maybe the quick wins that they should be looking at that really does provide a return straight away and gets them some momentum and some excitement about the project?
When I have a look at pharmacies, what I normally find is that they aren't doing all the complementary products that they can. They aren't selling all of the probiotics with the antibiotics, all of those sorts of things. They aren't increasing the basket size. And that the first place to always start is look at the complementary products, look at the basket size and see what little things you can do to improve on that. The secondary thing that I often look at is looking at the pricing in a pharmacy. And if somebody's got something priced at $9.75, if you increase that pricing to $9.85, the customers aren't going to complain. And that extra 10 cents here or there on a lot of products can significantly improve the profitability of the pharmacy.
How do we go about pricing professional services? Because there will be some costs associated with professional services that have already been incurred, like rent, for example, but then some additional costs directly associated with offering those new services. How does a pharmacy go about trying to figure out what they should charge for some of those new services?
Yeah, there's two schools of thought when it comes to this. One is to say that you should be looking at what are the direct costs, what additional costs have you incurred in providing that service. Now, look at the direct costs and see what additional costs you've incurred in providing that service. If you're not having to increase staff, you're not having to increase the number of pharmacists on duty, any of those sorts of things, then is there any direct labour cost associated with providing that service? Probably no. Have you produced or built a special room that's associated with that? Is that an additional cost? The way I've always liked to have a look at things is to say, look at the costs in two parts. Firstly, what are the sunk costs? Do I already have the staff? Do I already have the rent that I'm paying? Am I already incurring the electricity? All of those sorts of costs, the sunk costs, you're going to incur them no matter what that ends up happening. So as a starting point, there's no none of those costs need to go towards the pricing of the service. If you do have to incur additional costs or even using additional materials for doing diabetes checks or anything along those lines, then those costs are the starting point. So once you've got an understanding of what additional labour or additional costs that you've incurred, you can then say, what additional fee do I want to charge to contribute towards the overall costs of the pharmacy? So let's say the cost of providing a service, if you wanted to say was the labour, was $10, $15 for 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever it is, then you can say, okay, that's the initial cost. I want to provide another $10 towards the overheads of the pharmacy, the sunk costs of the pharmacy. I'll charge $25. But that's the way to do it. The mini thesis that I put together many, many years ago was an activity-based costing. And unfortunately, you can spend days going through working out what the real costs are associated with doing these things with very little benefit. So first off, start with the direct costs, labour or any additional rent. Sometimes I've got pharmacies that have gone and rented an additional room for providing these services at the time they're providing these services. That's a direct cost. So identify what the costs are first.
So we've got an idea of the professional services we want to diversify into. We've done our work and we've set the pricing. We're pretty comfortable with that. Give us a sense of the sort of KPIs we should be looking at to set around professional services. Is it, you know, number of consults? Is it the income that comes in? What are the KPIs that pharmacies you talk to generally look to set?
Well, it comes back to what professional services you're talking about, like clinical interventions. As a minimum, you should be doing at least 3.5% of your script volume. I always say to people, target a little bit more than that, 4% or thereabouts, so that way you've got a buffer if you don't get if you get caught up along the way and don't document all your clinical interventions. Meds checks, you should be doing at least 20, trying to do as many diabetes meds checks as you can during the month to try and meet your targets. And if you can set those up or try and do those at the beginning of the month, then it means you're not racing at the end of the month to try and finish those hours. DAAs, we all should know what our caps are. So you should be trying to exceed those caps because, as we've recently seen, those caps are increasing. And I'm seeing pharmacies at the moment that are actually being paid for more DAAs than what the caps are. So working through those so that you can understand them. The recent changes in stage supply are making it a little bit more difficult, but you're still needing to try and maximise those as well.
Some pharmacies seem to enjoy huge success just year to year, just more services, more vibrant, seem really happy, while others not so much. Whether you are looking to own your own pharmacy one day or maybe a sale is on the horizon, you may consider using the services of a business broker like Natalie Siriani from Attain, who specialises in pharmacy. Natalie has over 12 years' experience working in pharmacy valuation, research, management consulting, and business broking, and she shared that with us in episode 5.
Overall, the market's performing really well. So we do see a lot of peaks and troughs in terms of how the market does perform. But at the moment, we're seeing it's very strong. What we're seeing is we've got good demand side, so a lot of buyers looking to get into the market. And the supply, just because of the way, obviously, pharmacy ownership works in Australia, the supply of pharmacies on the market is always going to be limited. Supply has picked up in recent years, but it's still fairly low compared to what the demand levels is. So what we're finding is, as a result, there's lots of demand looking to buy a fairly small number of businesses on the market, and that's leading to overall a well-performing market at the moment. Having said that, what we're finding is there are a few different tiers to the market. So the type of pharmacy that it is, the location for where it is, the size and operational characteristics as well, you know, they can strongly impact on the overall result of the business sale. So although we say, yeah, overall it's quite a good market, each individual business can have, I guess, a very different reality once it does go to market. And that just depends on what the buyers are looking for. But overall, in my time in business sales, the last year and a half has probably been the most active and the most robust market that I've seen.
And is that pharmacy business sales market performance and as you said, the most robust, is it generally in line with the overall business sales market in Australia at the moment?
Yeah, it can vary a lot in terms of different industries. So the way that I probably see most of what's going on in other industries is through my networking and colleagues of other business brokers that specialise in different industries, whether it be hospitality or financials or professional type businesses. What we're finding at the moment, as I did say, the pharmacy market's relatively robust, and part of the reason it is so robust is because pharmacy buyers and owners have really good sources and access to finance, and most of that finance is coming through the banks, and the Australian banks are very positive about pharmacy and they are willing to lend at good rates to pharmacists and pharmacy owners in particular. And what we're finding at the moment is in other small and medium-sized businesses in other industries, their access to finance or access to capital is much lower than what we're seeing in pharmacy. So what that's meant in recent years for other industries is that even though interest rates are at record lows, those business owners are struggling to get the capital and struggling to get that finance from banks and even other lending facilities. And because of that, the business sales in other industries is not performing as well as pharmacy. So we're very lucky in pharmacy in that that access to capital is very strong and hopefully will remain that way. And because of that, it means that our industry has performed well compared to other small to medium-sized enterprise business sales markets. From my point of view, probably the recent Royal Banking Commission will mean that perhaps those other industries may even have a further reduction in access to capital. And I'm really interested to see how that plays out as well for pharmacy and if that will have an impact for pharmacy moving forward. But obviously it's still very early days in terms of how that plays out.
Natalie, what are the main differences between sole ownerships and partnerships when it comes to pharmacies? And I'm interested in if there are any benefits to either one, either based on people's circumstances, or are there any traps or dangers people need to be wary of with either one?
Yeah, definitely. And that's a really big one that we're seeing a lot at the moment, Daniel, because partnerships and ownership, you know, can be very different and certainly well-suited to some people and not well-suited to other people. But what we find at the moment is that because in terms of the price and the capital required to get into a pharmacy business or into pharmacy ownership, we're finding a lot of people are moving towards partnership options because there's less capital required for them to get into a business. So what it means is that they can buy a portion of the business and it allows for a lower point of entry. So they don't have to fund the full purchase price, obviously, to get into the business. And there are ways that you can structure the partnership so they don't require as much finance upfront as they would otherwise. The partnerships provide a great benefit of that. So an incoming buyer can have less capital than they would need to buy a whole business. But also what it provides with is the incoming partner is often perhaps a first-time pharmacy owner. And what you find is that the senior partner or the business owner that's already there can provide a great mentoring role. Younger person coming in, or doesn't necessarily have to be younger person, but, you know, the newer owner. And what you find then as well is that in turn, the incoming partner will provide a lot of new energy and ideas for the business and innovation for the business as well. So it's really a win-win situation, but the most important thing that it actually works. So both the senior and the junior partner need to get on fairly well in terms of their operation. And also you have to have a really good understanding for whose roles are what. and what each party needs to do, and also what each party gets paid as well. So while partnership can be a really good way to do it, there are some risks associated with it, and you do see sometimes when we get into cases of partnership disputes where, and often it's when there's no partnership agreement and there's not clear-cut rules for what each partner can and will do. In terms of ownership, sole ownership, obviously, you know, it makes it a lot simpler in the sense that you're the only one that needs to make the decisions. You can make all the decisions that you want. But in contrast to that, you do take on all the risk as well. So you have to have the full capital going in. And if there is a problem, there's not really usually someone that you can lean on to do that. So it's usually a personal preference whether people do like to go into partnership or full ownership. Sometimes it's how the opportunity arises. But historically, partnerships have worked really well in pharmacy, and I see real a great opportunity for them moving forward just because of the, you know, the high prices for pharmacies being paid and the capital required as well. I think it's, you know, a really important part of the industry.
How much does the success of partnerships that you've seen that have worked really well are almost needed because quite often pharmacies are 7 days a week and it's great to have an owner there pretty much all of the time?
And what you find is that most businesses where the partnerships work well, the partners are actually working in the businesses, and when they're 7 day traders or extended trading during the week, that becomes really important. And what we find is that most pharmacies that do have a owner operator there, whether it's a partnership or a full owner, a sole proprietor working there, it definitely does improve the performance of the business. And so that's something that you really see. You know, they've got long trading hours, obviously high capital requirements. The partnership is a really good way to address those issues for sure.
There is a change in the industry with pressure from PBS reform, expanded competition, and the need for preventative and primary health care. There is lots of opportunities on lots of fronts, but that takes commitment and resources. It is a challenge, and it can be hard to determine where to start if you want to improve your pharmacy. Yet, clearly, growing the business is a key focus for most pharmacies, and Ashley Smith from Instigo is an expert in helping pharmacies change and grow, and she shared her expertise with us in Episode 7.
The opportunity analysis is a calculator which allows a pharmacy owner to measure their current opportunity in professional services as well as see where are the areas of improvement. So the cost for an opportunity analysis is $149, which gives that pharmacy owner 12 months access to run up to a total of 5 reports. So it's a great way to be able to monitor ongoing success. So you can run a report today, we can set some, you know, small SMART goals for the future, and you can run that report in another 3, 6, you know, 9 months' time along the track just to see how you're going with some of those initial goals that you set yourself. However, in saying that, as part of the 2018-19 membership, the Pharmacy Guild has provided members with access to an opportunity analysis, which includes a feedback session as well. So pharmacies have been provided with some logins from their business support team at their local branches. So that's fantastic for everyone to get behind. The other question you asked is, how long does it take? Look, to do it properly, the right way, it takes about 20 to 30 minutes to ensure that you've got all the data and you've entered everything in. When you conduct an opportunity analysis, it'll ask you some current statistics on your business. So how are you currently performing in some areas? And it will also ask you to set some goals as to what you would like these areas to improve to. So how many med checks are you currently conducting per month, and how many med checks would you like to be conducting each month? You know, how many patients do you have enrolled on a prescription reminder service currently, and over a 12-month period, what would you like to see that increase to? So it looks into how you're currently performing, and by providing some of that information, it allows us to set what that additional opportunity may look like based on your individual business goals, as well as looking at, you know, caps that are in place with 6CPA and so on.
So the other thing I wanted to know was, you spoke about how running an opportunity analysis is important so that we can make informed decisions. In your opinion, is there anything else that is really important and is one of the reasons that we might run an opportunity analysis?
I think at the end of the day, an opportunity analysis tells you in regards to professional services how you're performing. So that's step one. First of all, you should know your numbers. It's so important. So I think first step is it's going to tell you how you're currently performing. It's going to tell you whether you're missing out on any other opportunity. Many community pharmacies don't understand their worth when it comes to professional services. So at the end of the day, this report is going to give you those numbers.
So you spoke a couple of times about we get a report at the end. We can run that report multiple times over the year and see how we're tracking. But what is the actual output at the end of the opportunity analysis? What does the pharmacy owner have in their hand to action? What things are covered in that report that they can look at?
My favourite thing, numbers. They have the numbers. This is so important. I can't tell you how many pharmacy owners I've spoken to that, like I said, they don't understand the worth of these services. So this report will tell them, based on a few different key areas, what their current opportunity is, as well as an estimate as to what they're missing out on. Now, those areas that it covers are things such as 6 CPA. So let's make sure that that's our starting point and we know that, you know, what our current and estimate is in that area. We will look at things such as, you know, prescription reminder services, things such as the Guild Care Pharma program, so things like nutotherapy and compliance programs that are funded, you know, to community pharmacy. We'll look at fee-for-service as well. So we'll look at things such as, you know, vaccination, you know, blood glucose monitoring or any other services. So a pharmacy may have a weight loss program, for example, that they run that's independent to them. So we'll look at all the different areas when it comes to professional services and provide that pharmacy with some numbers on what their current opportunity is as well as what the estimates are for them on what they're missing out on. So it does cover a pretty broad range of different professional services depending on obviously what that pharmacy's offer is. But they can also use that report to, if they're not currently providing a service such as a weight management, you know, program, for example, they may use that report to say, well, currently I'm not doing anything in this area, but I'd like to introduce something where I'm conducting 10 or, you know, 20 services per month where I would charge X amount of dollars for each of those. So it can help them to even look at, I guess, potential areas to move into the future. If they look at the report and they think, oh, hang on a second, I'm not doing that or I'm not doing this, this is relevant to me, they can still use it to maybe plan for the future as to what maybe that's something they want to look into.
So to be clear, you're talking about running a report. It looks at some of the things they're doing, sets some goals, but it also looks at some things that they might not be doing that they might be able to add. Are you implying that if we just picked weight loss consultations as an example, that they're being benchmarked, so to speak, against what other pharmacies might deliver in their totality? So we might have a list of, 50, 60 different professional services, and they get marked off with what they're currently delivering and then some suggestions around what other pharmacies are offering that they could consider?
Yeah, so they'll see. So in the list of other services that we've covered there, it's extremely detailed and we have used, obviously, you know, our knowledge from the industry as to what other people are providing at this point in time. So there may be things on that list that someone, you know, is filling out and they may think, oh, I'm not doing that. You know, that could be something that we think about into the future. Or I guess the most common thing is, I've always wanted to look in, you know, to implementing that into the pharmacy. Let's include that into the report.
Innovation can help a pharmacy realise lots of opportunities. Gerald Burns Pharmacy in Bicton, WA was the 2018 Pharmacy Guild of Australia Guild Pharmacy of the Year in the category of professional innovation. So, who better to join us for episode 8 to discuss professional innovation in pharmacy than Amanda Bryce from Gerald Burns Pharmacy? Your win in the professional innovation category was because the pharmacy has undergone a huge transformation, taking the focus away from the dispensary and moving it to an integrative medicine offering. From a market perspective, how did you actually determine that there was actual demand for integrative medicine?
I suppose we felt a bit at a loss that we weren't able to help people with specific queries. Like, our patients knew way more about this than we did. So there was that deficiency in our knowledge. But what really brought it home to me is that I had a look at the ScriptMap 2020 report a few years ago, and what I noticed is that the patients of Gerald Burns Pharmacy take 1.5 times more antidepressants than the regular Australian, and they have twice the prevalence of autoimmune disease. So our demographic are sicker and more stressed and more depressed than anybody else in Australia. And I thought, wow, you know, we live in a very nice suburb. How does this happen? And then looking, drilling down a little bit more, they're the sandwich generation. So they've got the elderly parents. They're stressed out about mum and dad and nursing home. And they've got young kids. And they, the kids are stressing them out as well. So I just thought, how can we help them to increase their health and well-being? And really, it came down to an integrative approach. We have to look at the whole person, not just this specific symptom. So that's really what we did, is we decided, I think that there's something in it for this. It's a point of difference for us. It's not going to be price sensitive. It takes time. You know, you have to be upskilled, obviously. But the response from our patients was phenomenal. And, you know, it's testament to how we've gone.
Outstanding. I love it. What were some of the internal challenges that you've had to overcome in moving to an integrative medicine approach, either on the staff front or the process front?
I suppose it's a commitment to ongoing education. Things change all the time. So, yeah, it's all about upskilling continuously. The other thing is that when you're talking to someone, you're not sure if it's going to be a 2-minute conversation or a 20-minute conversation. So you always need to have adequate staff on to help support you with that. You know, so I've always got 3 or 4 pharmacists on at the same time. So, yes, my wages bill is phenomenally expensive. But if you have a look at our sales per square metre, we're almost treble what industry average is. So, you know, it's swings and roundabouts, really. And I think if you're going to offer an integrative approach, you have to have, you know, lots and lots of staff on to support that.
And what about from a process point of view? Were there any processes within the shop that you had to change or challenges you had to overcome to ensure that you could deliver what you wanted to deliver?
Some of the things that we were doing, I noticed that we could make it more efficient by turning it into a protocol. So that's how the 3-step gut healing protocol sort of developed, because we were having the same conversation over and over and handwriting down what we wanted. So that was something that dramatically increased our efficiency. We just found that so many people had the same symptoms of IBS, diarrhea dominant, or gastric reflux disease, or diarrhea as a result from a course of antibiotics. So now I've got that sheet that's ready to go. That's dramatically improved our process of having that conversation more quickly. And it also means that maybe they don't want to buy something today. Perhaps they just want to have a think about it, or they want to have a look into the science that's behind your suggestion. So often there is not a sale that results. It's just a matter of, you know, continuing to tweak them towards thinking that there's another way. So, yeah, it is an ongoing process all the time.
If you think something is worthwhile for your customers, will you just offer it or just make it happen irrespective of the financial angle and the business, or do you need to really carefully balance the needs of the patient with those of the pharmacy as a business?
Yeah, no, we do have to consider the shelf space that it takes. I've got a few criteria. I need to make sure that it's a niche product, so it's not available in Coles or at the health food store. I'd like something that's a bit quirky, something unusual, something that's preferably West Australian. It has to be health related. I like it if there's a story behind it. So, for example, our hot packs, hand sewn by a local lady who developed breast cancer, and she couldn't find a specific hot pack that met her needs. So she sewed her own, and then her business just grew out of that. So we sell Pat's hot packs, which is great. But price really is my last consideration. If you've got all the other things right, the price is not that relevant.
Sounds fantastic. Success like you have enjoyed doesn't just come about because you have a great product or service idea and just offer it. That's obviously important, but staff plays such a huge role in success. What do you think makes Gerald Burns' staff so special?
Oh, I just think that they're all incredible. You know, we spend a lot of time together, and we're just like a healthy microbiome. We're really diverse. We've got all different cultures, ages, you know, languages, everything. But everyone is so committed to their role. And I think I give them autonomy. You know, they do what they want. They feel really comfortable at work. And I know we all have a joint purpose to serve our patients really, really well. So I think that's how we get on together.
Success is often measured against goals and metrics. What are some of those hard metrics that prove that you've made the right choice in some of those transformations and particularly into integrative medicine?
I'm sure the quadrupling of the professional services, that has had a huge impact on our hard metrics. And other things, like we put in a few books and then that just has snowballed. And now our books went from, we're selling one a week to now we sell 10 a week. So again, all health related. And they're really great as a tool to start that conversation about, you know, this is how else you can help yourself. Our complementary medicine sales increased by 13% in 12 months. And that really offset the loss that we experienced with the codeine sales. So yeah, we're going great.
Lucy Walker, owner of Terry White Chemmart Gundawindi, was recognised as the 2017 winner of the Community Engagement category for the Pharmacy Guild of Australia Pharmacy of the Year and went on also to win the overall Pharmacy of the Year in 2017. In episode 9, Lucy joined us and discussed how community pharmacy in rural communities is not just a job, but instead a lifestyle. You obviously engage very well, as you were recognised as the 2017 winner of the Community Engagement category for the Guild Pharmacy of the Year, and you're also recognised as the overall winner of the award, so a big congratulations on that. The award recognises pharmacies that have transformed their business. Can you talk us through what changes you've implemented that meant that you were able to transform your pharmacy into an award-winning one that it is today?
So when I purchased the pharmacy, it was what I call a renovator's delight. Bill had the pharmacy for a number of years and it just hadn't grown or changed for a while. So I got in there with all my crazy ideas because I'd been working a few years and we actually got a really good team around us as well. So it definitely wasn't all me. It was the lovely women that I work with as well. And some of the things we did is we did a major refit after a couple of years of owning it. I looked into how we could become a better pharmacy and I tried everything myself and I got to the stage where like we're going to need to brand. So we branded and with that branding we then did a major refit. And I suppose with anything you've got to invest time and effort. I actually remember going to business courses and working on business plans and I still have a business plan every year and try and make myself accountable for it. And so that would have been about 5 years ago. And then last year we even did another minor little refit where we put in a robot. So that required more planning and changing and but so what I've found is with every change and you're looking at what systems and processes and we have in place and what can we make better and we just constantly keep on changing to help our customers better but to be in a better position to be able to as well.
You're also a successful business owner, a guild elected official. You're a pivotal member of the Gundawindi community, Churchill Fellowship, MBA student, but you're also a mother and a wife. Are there challenges in juggling all of those priorities?
Absolutely. I'm not going to lie and say I've got it perfect. I actually did a business course with my husband when we first took over the pharmacy. And one of the basic things that he said that we've really kept as a big priority, one mantra is get home right first. And as a point of view, you know, your family and home is the most important thing. So I know I can't concentrate on work if I've got a child that's sick and not being cared for. So I make sure that I surround myself with people much, much better than I. So right now in the pharmacy, I'm not worried what's going on because I've got a great team of pharmacists and pharmacy assistants who are passionate about what they do and are serving customers right as we speak brilliantly well. At home, I also have an au pair. So I in Gundy, I don't have any family support. So we've got great friends, and I have an au pair who helps, you know, pick up the kids from school, make dinner. So when I come home, I can actually play with the kids and engage with them, not fight over who's going to help me cook dinner. So look, there is a lot of, it's a juggle, but it's enjoyable as well. I actually love having a challenge, and it's just knowing that, yes, if I have to, it's okay to drop a ball and say I have to focus on my family right now. And also with the pharmacy, we always prioritise the pharmacy first too. If, you know, say I might want to go to a community event, but if we're short on staff because two people are sick, and I sort of have to say, look, we've got to maintain our priority of running a pharmacy business first before I can do things outside. So, yeah, you just get your priorities right and go from there.
Is it fair to say that the family, the home front, as you said, get that right first, sets a platform for you to be able to focus on the business, and then once you've got that set, you've got a platform to go and do wider engagement and help the community?
Yes, yes, and that's how I prioritise things.
What's some advice you'd give to young people, especially females who are in the early parts of their pharmacy careers, apart from maybe getting out to their some picnic races in some rural communities? What would be your advice?
I would actually say become a master of our craft. So as a young student, actually, when I finished pharmacy, I wasn't too sure, but I was thinking about doing medicine. And I remember speaking to a few mentors, and one actually said, you know what, you could go and study medicine for the next 5 years and come out and become a pretty average GP, or you could actually focus on the next 5 years and become a bloody awesome pharmacist. And I really took that to heart and thought, you know what, you've finished a degree, why don't I just really make the most of it? And so where I think as pharmacists we have so much more potential is mastering our craft. Whether you want to become a home medicine, and that's what I love about pharmacy, there's so many potential avenues you can go to. So when, as a young pharmacist, I did work in the UK when you're allowed to. So that was great to see another country and how they operate there. I worked in a hospital setting. I managed a pharmacy the first year out after graduating. I also did my home medicines review, and I did a diploma in clinical pharmacy. So there's so many things you can do. I worked for the National Prescribing Service doing academic detailing. You know, there's those skills of becoming a better pharmacist helps you for the rest of your life as a profession, and you gain skills in so many different areas.
You spoke about avenues, and everybody's going to have choices in their life to pursue one avenue or pursue another. And there's often a preconception that rural demographics miss out on life, which can stop younger potential employees maybe making the move to a rural area. Why would you encourage some of those people to consider taking up a role in a rural location?
I've found rural pharmacy to be a really enjoyable and valuable role. Probably the basic, as a young person, you get paid more. So as a rural pharmacist, and every owner will always, to attract pharmacists, you'll get a better pay rate. There's also more opportunities to do more. So you'll be given more mentoring by any owners because they want you to stay. You'll be given more opportunities to manage stores or people. You'll also, being within that store, you'll get to practice your craft more. You get to know more people in a professional setting, so you can collaborate more with people, because the, you know, you'll become friends with the local GP who you also play tennis with. And then when you have to call them up to ask them a question, it's really quite easy. So I think you don't miss out, and you're more engaged when you're actually in a rural community. And when you're young, you can just try it. I came out to Gundy with the idea that I'd just be here for a year and see if I enjoyed it or not, and now I can't imagine living anywhere else.
The Pharmacy Assistant of the Year Award is the premier award for Australian pharmacy assistants, recognising and celebrating the best of the best in community pharmacy. This prestigious award recognises the important contribution pharmacy assistants make to the pharmacy industry and is a chance to celebrate the passion and commitment of pharmacy assistants. The 2018 winner was Alice van der Poel from Moama Village Pharmacy in New South Wales, and she joined us in episode 10 to share her journey.
Interestingly enough, I would have to say the people. And yep, crazy as it sounds, I came from a career where I was quite happily sitting out the back patting dogs and cats. But now I actually love the people. I've actually grown to have a deep affection for people, especially the older generation. I see, you know, the vulnerability that these older patients have as they come in, and the simple fact of being able to help manage their scripts. You know, they come in with a handful of scripts and say, I don't know what I'm doing, please help. And just to be able to just do that simple fact of being able to help them in that way is so rewarding. So it have to be the customers. Definitely, number one. Also, the knowledge, like the product knowledge and the medicine knowledge that I've gained since being there is mind-blowing. There's still so much to learn. I don't think you'll ever get to the point where you learn everything or know everything, and I think that's the beauty of our job, is that you're learning something new every single day. There's a new challenge, and, yeah, so that's what I really, really love.
So, Alice, take us through a typical day at work and how you support the pharmacist to deliver healthcare, as well as maybe any daily processes, just to ensure that there is a well-functioning shop.
So I think the most important thing as pharmacy assistants, I believe, is being knowledgeable. So that can come from obviously being upskilled and learning, so doing extra study as well. So if you're not currently doing any extra study and you want to, just put it out there, have a chat to your bosses about it. You know, make it happen, because I really believe that this helps the pharmacy function a lot better. I mean, our role is we're the first point of contact for customers. And so to be able to have that knowledge in answering their questions enough so that maybe we can proceed to the sale, I think helps the pharmacist a lot. Obviously, you've got to know your scope of practice too. So if there's any things that you don't know, that's fine. Just say, look, you know, I'd love to just grab the pharmacist and I'd love for them to have a bit of a chat to you. They may be able to answer some of these questions. And so I think in our pharmacy, you know, in particular, our pharmacists are really trusting in the fact that they're like, go serve the customer, do as much as you can, answer as much as you can. So they've got a real trust in us, in our knowledge. And they're like, yep, sure, don't hesitate to come and grab me if you're not sure of anything. So it's a really great place to be able to do that. I mean, some pharmacies could be generally different, you know, with the need to have to grab a pharmacist every single time, like even just, you know, dealing with your general, maybe a gastro or a thrush or something like that. So I think that helps the practice and, you know, the pharmacy itself flow a lot better if we can actually handle some of these other conversations instead of having to bother the pharmacist as much as we do. This frees up their time, I think, the most important thing to realise, to be able to specialise in maybe diabetes care or asthma management, do meds checks and do other things that we can't do. So that's also with, you know, doing all the dispensing as well, being able to handle most of that and then just get them to check it off and then say, yep, sure, just go to the customer, et cetera. So I just think if we have knowledge, there's power in that. So an educated pharmacy assistant is by far a better pharmacy assistant and helps the pharmacy itself run a lot smoother.
It has been great having you listen into the first 10 episodes of the show, and now this one, episode 11. Thank you so much for sharing your precious time. listening to the show, and we are very much looking forward to producing more shows on the topics you most want in 2019. Most importantly, thank you so much to all the guests who have found the time to share their experiences and knowledge with us. It truly has been fantastic. As always, if you are thinking of exploring how your pharmacy can transform and grow, members, don't forget, you can always contact your local Guild branch for further information and support. Or you can visit guild.org.au to access a complete range of diagnostic and operational support tools to assist you in identifying current opportunities available to your pharmacy, target business areas that require attention, and then provide the operational support needed to do something about it. Visit guild.org.au for more information. Until next time, I'm Daniel Oyston, and you've been listening to episode 11 of the Pharmacy, Business and Career Network podcast, brought to you by the Pharmacy Guild of Australia.
The PBCN podcast, supporting your journey every step of the way. For more resources, to access support or advice, or to view this episode's show notes, visit guild.org.au.